You are listening to the Photo Bomb Podcast with the world's greatest photographers, Boo Ray and Gary.
Hi, welcome to the Photo Bomb Podcast. My name is Boo Ray Perry, and joining me as always is Gary Hughes.
Hey, hey.
And I would like to change our theme song to ZZ Top's I Got to Get Paid. Right?
It's such a great song.
Instead of that music, it would just be $25 on my dresser.
Yeah, yeah.
Got to get paid. Yeah. And then we would come in.
I can't believe you hadn't heard that before.
No, I haven't heard
that. We were just
talking
before we started recording that I've been listening to a lot of AC/DC and ZZ Top recently. Long story short, I just go through phases where I'll listen to one band for like a month, and we were talking about how great ZZ Top was, how long they've been around. I said, have you heard their newest
right
stuff? And it's called you can look it up on Vimeo or somewhere, or YouTube. It's called Gots to Get Paid, and it's just an unabashed like music video hotties and just
yes
and pouring water on themselves,
cut off shorts and heels
and hot,
sorry,
yeah.
You see all the time, by the way,
and hot rods
in the desert.
Yeah, in the desert, just driving around the desert in hot rods, custom hot rods, and like with just hot chicks pouring water on themselves. Yeah. It's just like brings the 80s. It's unashamedly like just out there as, hey, we're ZZ Top,
and in the corner of the screen a little countdown clock to the next time that Thriller is going to play.
Right.
Little shout out for all you folks who really remember TV in the 80s.
I was listening to Dire Straits actually on, you know, they're so iconic. I think
Mark Knopfler, top five guitarist in the world,
he and plays with his fingers. But I think we've talked about him before actually. But I was listening to Money for Nothing, you know, and in the beginning it's Sting singing,
I want my MTV.
And I'm thinking, I don't want my MTV anymore. Like, it used to be such an amazing part of life.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Like, I remember so vividly, like, as a probably middle school, even in high school, like, teenage culture revolving around MTV and the music that they played.
Yep.
And it's just not to me, and maybe because I've aged out of it, but I don't think that it is what it was.
Well, it's not anywhere near what it is. First of all, they stopped playing music videos.
Right.
But when it came out, even they were surprised because they thought that it would be like radio, that kids would use it, maybe have it on in their room. And they were surprised to discover that kids were coming home from school, turning it on and staring at it.
Right.
Just sitting there and watching it like a soap opera, watching video after video. And that was not, they did not anticipate that. They thought it'll play in your room all the time instead of a radio. And every once in a while you might look at it, but they didn't think it would be appointment viewing. Sit down and just watch every video as it comes up, what's next. And it was huge.
The truth is though that they had to change because music videos are all getting released on YouTube and stuff, and like you could just go on Facebook and YouTube and Vimeo, and you could just on demand watch whatever music video you feel like, whereas you used to like even call in and request, and you used to sit there and wait for the song that you wanted to come on.
Yep.
Getting your VHS ready, you pop the tape in and hit record, and you could, you know, it used to be a thing where you had to pay attention to it, and now it's just entertainment on demand with the internet. So of course they had to change their business model. I'm not bagging on MTV. I'm sure all their shows are terrible, but you know, it's just the way old people.
And then you
feel
had, and then you had, if you had a friend who didn't have like cable, then all they had was Friday Night Videos, which came on like NBC on Friday nights.
Right.
Carson wouldn't be on. They would have Friday Night Videos, and they would watch that. And you'd be like, Friday Night, I have MTV, dude.
Yeah, dude.
I watch MTV every day.
Headbangers Ball.
Yeah. Even that's after my time.
Yeah.
I'm like Martha Quinn, J.J. Jackson.
Like the original
VJs. The original crew. Yeah. I watched MTV like from the first like month it came on the air.
Yeah, I mean, I think probably high school was, when I was in high school, was the latter part of high school, was the Carson Daly era of
TRL. I was gone by then. Big haired. Yeah, I was.
But when I was a kid, it was still very much like the claymation, stop motion,
right.
You know, cut out.
Nah.
I could still, I mean, they used to still play Video Killed the Radio Star and stuff like that when I was little. But, you know, it's changed into a different thing. But I was also thinking about, I went to the movies this past week. And I saw X-Men Apocalypse.
Which, oh, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Because, you know, I'm a kind of a into the nerd culture like a lot of people now. But, X-Men was a huge comic book for me as a kid. And I've followed the movies and stuff like that. And anyway, so I went to see the movie. And I'm sitting there with my good buddy Johnny. And we're watching the previews coming. And I remember the previews to be the most exciting part of the movie for me. Like, to the point where you're watching the previews and the movie, you forget what movie you're there to watch because you're so excited about the previews, you know. And I think that was inevitable. However, this time, because of the internet and the way stuff's released now, every trailer that came on, I'd already seen.
Right.
You know? And yeah. So it was a lot less exciting. Like, I'm sitting there and I'm tempted to pull my phone out or just to have a conversation during the preview. And instead, when the previews would come on...
They used to be a big deal.
At that point, you go, shh, shh, shh. And now people talk through the previews because they've freaking seen them all.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And we did have a moment where I had to ask the people next to us to be quiet because they wouldn't stop talking.
But, really?
Yeah, yeah. That doesn't happen that much because I really try to avoid going to the movies when it's busy. I'll go to like a Sunday evening show, like when, you know, they slow down, because typically Friday and Saturday are huge. And then I'll even wait till the following week and always go on like a Sunday when nobody's going to go.
We go to one of those places over here that's got the, you know, you go in and you have your own tray and they come out and they bring you food and everything in the theater.
Yeah, man. Oh, that's great. Yeah, those are, we have the Cinema Grill.
It's reserved seating.
By my house. Yeah, yeah.
You pick your seat.
Yeah, love it.
It's like, let me ask you, in the movie there, Olivia Munn in the Psylocke in the purple leotard outfit and everything.
Yep.
Looking pretty good.
Yeah. Olivia Munn's just a stunning.
I'm in love with
beautiful
her.
Woman.
I love Olivia Munn on every
used to watch her on TV, you know, and she was doing screensavers.
She's a huge and geek, and I love her.
Yeah, she's a real deal. She's very cool. She did a good job. The problem is it's like.
By the way, black belt in Taekwondo.
Yeah, I believe it. For me, coming from geek culture, Olivia Munn has been a goddess for like a decade, you know, and she's been on the cover of so many magazines and Wired and different stuff like that. And when you see her, it almost like I don't see Psylocke. I see Olivia Munn.
Olivia Munn.
It's like when Tom Cruise in any role that Tom Cruise is in is like he's Tom Cruise. Like, you don't think, what was the name of Tom Cruise's character in Far and Away?
I don't know.
Exactly. Well, you know, you just don't know. Unless the name of the movie is the character's name, like Jack Reacher. You don't know what the heck his name was.
He's just Tom Cruise.
Okay, but his name was Maverick in Top Gun, but what was Maverick's actual name?
His actual name was, give me a second, because it was Stencil,
exactly.
I don't know.
Because he's Tom Cruise. Know. Who cares?
Yeah.
What was his name in Days of Thunder? Cole Trickle.
Cole Trickle.
That's the one I think everybody knows.
And could there be a better movie name than Cole Trickle? Cole Trickle?
I don't know.
Really?
So,
all right. So listen, we've got to talk about the last week. We didn't do a show last week. We had a show in the can. We did not put it on the air.
Yes.
Because of what happened in Orlando. And you and I have talked about this on the air, and you're like, I don't want to do a whole show. I don't want to make the whole show about Orlando. But you live in Orlando.
Yes.
And I don't think that we can do a show with, especially with you living in Orlando, without really talking about Orlando.
Right.
Well, what happened. And you, I mean, you were there.
Yeah. Well, I wasn't there.
But you were there. You were closer than anybody.
It's the city in which I live. And it's, and I got to, first, I want to say that nothing irritates me more is when something like this happens and every single person starts getting on social media and trying to connect themselves to it. Like, oh, my house is only a couple of miles from there. And that, you know, it's like, because people tend to try to make these things about them personally, you know, and that has always irritated me about these types of tragedies, but nothing like this has ever happened where I live before. Mm-hmm. And so I understand that impulse more. I will say I didn't know any of the individuals involved. I am once removed from several people. You know
somebody who knows somebody.
Right. I have friends that have worked for me and worked with me that knew people there. I even know of relationally some people who were around there that night, but you know, and it happened at Pulse, which is where our local Orlando affiliate PPSCF used to meet at this private catering restaurant on the second floor, and it's literally across the street from Pulse. Like, you know, I'm really familiar with the area. I have friends that work at the hospital right there. You know, it is an impactful part of what's been going on in our community. I mean, it's been a tough week all around. We just found out, you know, yesterday about a young boy who was, you know, 2-year-old boy who was dragged into a lake by an alligator at Disney. And just before the day before the mass shooting at Pulse, the you know, the singer Christy Grimley, I think was her name, and somebody walked right into the plaza and shot her. And and that's terrible because we go to shows there. Like, I've been to 4 or 5 times over the last couple of years. We go and we see concerts there. It's one of our favorite places to go see stuff. So I mean, this is like real stuff that's happening. So in light of all the heaviness, I just haven't felt up to really doing anything.
You said that it's not just a question of not wanting to do the podcast, but you just, it's a general malaise that comes over you.
I certainly haven't had the feeling like I'm afraid to go out or afraid to do anything. You know, that just hasn't, because the incident, the president has come to Orlando, and they're not going to bring the president into a war zone, right? Like, he came on Thursday, or he's coming, he's addressing today, I think, Orlando. So he's in town. And there, if the FBI and law enforcement agency, the Secret Service, have not already completely vetted, the incident is over, there's nobody connected to it, there's no more danger,
right,
they would not bring the president to Orlando.
Right, right.
So, like, you know, that's how, I don't feel logically that there's any danger to go out and to do things. But I do, it does feel extremely strange to just do normal things. Like, I went to lunch. My friend Danny is a manager at this great restaurant by the studio, so I go there for lunch like once a week. And I was just sitting there eating lunch by myself, thinking, like, it feels the day after the shooting, and it feels so strange just to be out just doing anything. Like,
you feel like it's somehow a betrayal?
No, you just don't want to do anything. Like, you feel like you should be doing something else.
Something else. You don't know what that something is, but right, you shouldn't be in any way enjoying yourself or moving on with your life, because in some way you're moving on, and we don't want to move on. And it's, when do you move on? And
it's a distant cousin of like coming back to work after a long vacation, and you just feel out of place, okay, you know, and just everywhere feels out of place all the time. You don't know what to do. We go out to dinner. Are we okay? Is it okay if we laugh? You know,
right,
like, there's just so much. What basically the only way I can describe it is like, if there is a concrete center of your being, and I believe almost everybody in the world has this, that no matter what's going on, there's part of you that says, part of your brain that says, everything's going to be okay. It's this little concrete mass at the center of the universe. It's like, we'll get through this. Everything's going to be okay. The world is a good place. Like, we'll make, you know, good things will happen. Things will turn around. And there's that part of the human brain that just does that, you know? And I think that when this is the first time I've ever felt like that part got hit with a sledgehammer and put a big crack in it. Like,
right,
the part of me that thinks everything's going to be okay was damaged. And so, and I think that's the way a lot of us feel. And so, things are really, the most amazing part about it is that this animal who perpetrated this horrible, horrible crime and this mass shooting, this act of terror, completely failed in his objective. And yes, he ended 49 lives and potentially more. There are still people in critical condition, but he has advanced the agenda of the LGBT community. He has brought our city and our country together, you know, and as is, it's almost like Newton's third law. It's like an equal and opposite force will react, you know. And I was listening to an interesting podcast about this police detective who says, when you shoot someone, typically when someone dies on their feet, whether it be a shotgun blast or whatever, they fall on their face, like they go forward, you know. And that's right, part of Newton's third law of motion is
right,
equal and opposite.
Right.
And so the equal and opposite reaction of this is that you've got Democratic senators filibustering for gun control. Like, I feel like for the first time something's moving, like something has changed. And so who knows what's going to come of it. I don't want to come down politically on anything or talk about why it happened.
I'm okay talking a little bit politically.
I'm not.
I know you're not.
Because I've seen there's still so much more information to be had.
Right.
And one of the things that a lot of people that I know are irritated about is that everybody's posting their opinion on guns, on terrorism, on all this stuff, and everybody's posting what they think. And the bottom line is, it's you're shooting your mouth off when we don't even have all the facts.
Right.
You know, it'll take weeks and maybe even months before we know all the details of everything, while all these professional criminal investigation right, forces figure out what happened, figure out how big it was, what caused it, and everybody's got a stinking opinion. And you shouldn't. You should just shut right, up and let people do their right, job, and let's come together as a community.
I think though that we are going to discover that, technically speaking, that this, my opinion, technically speaking, I think we're going to find out that this was not in fact an act of terrorism, because an act of terrorism is to advance a political agenda. And I think we're going to find out that it wasn't about a political agenda, that it isn't a guy who was trying to achieve something for whatever. I think we're going to find that he was a whack job.
He was just
he had issues. And, you know, just like the guy who shot the church up in North Carolina or South Carolina,
yeah,
or the guy that shot the McDonald's 30 years ago, technically speaking, not an act of terrorism, just act of a madman.
Right. Yeah. So yeah. I honestly, we don't know. And I think it's better just to say, let's focus on rebuilding. Let's focus on, putting pressure on our community leaders and on our elected officials to do something, because right now we don't have data and we need that. We need to figure out the smartest way to approach. The bottom line is, we don't have one problem. There's not a gun problem. There's not a terrorism problem. There are multiple problems within both of those things that need to be addressed on multiple levels. And the bottom line is, something has to be done. And now I feel like something is being done, because it's getting to the point where it's just ridiculous. But without getting political, I just want, you know, we're going to get away from it. I'm not going to put down any opinions on what I think. Bottom line is, we all want less people to get shot.
Yeah.
You know, we all want less people to die like this.
Yes.
And so I don't care who's right or who's wrong, as long as less people start dying, you know,
right.
As long as less people die every year from this type of thing, whoever came up with the idea, whatever idea it was, at this point, I think we could kind of all get behind it, you know, but that's all going to be sorted out by people who are smarter than me. But I want to just say that, you know, we're going to be back doing what we do. We're going to talk about photography stuff. We're going to talk about business. We're going to talk about life. We're going to joke around.
Let me just say, by the way, I don't think those people are smarter than you, but okay.
the bottom line is, we're going to get back to doing what we do. It has affected us. I've spent over the last couple of days, I've gone to the studio to go to work, and I've just sit and stare at my computer screen for like an hour. I don't even know what to do with myself. Right. With this like list of stuff that I have to get done. And I feel so distracted by all of it and out of place. But we will heal. We will move forward. And things will, they will change, and then they will not. You know, things will move on. Like, life goes on, and it will. But, you know, we learn from it, and we grow together as a community. And we're going to keep doing what we're doing. Because what the unintended consequence of stuff like this is, small businesses get really, really hurt in an area where stuff like this happens.
Yeah, that was, well, you know, that's the ancillary thing that I was thinking about. As everything's going, and then as the news of the little boy at Disney World came out, I thought, okay, you know, not that this is the priority, but what's this going to do to the economy in Orlando?
Right. I have a kid about that age, and every year, as is normal in Florida, some dumbass from somewhere else doesn't understand the danger of standing water in a near equatorial tropical climate where alligators and large predators live. Florida is like
I had a gator sitting outside the fence in my backyard of my new house.
Yeah, Florida is like the Australia of America. Everything here will kill you. It's a very as far as wild people who grow up here. Wildlife education is a huge part of your schooling. Like, there's environmental education as part of every public school. You learn about how not to kill sea turtles and how to avoid alligators, and all this stuff is just ingrained in us. Any Floridian, anybody who grew up here, will look at a body of water and they'll go, oh, that's nice, I'm going to stay about 20 feet back at least from the shore. And I've even seen a dog get someone walking their dog down by a lake, and I've seen it get grabbed by
it happened at the golf course on my old house. It happened at the golf course,
and it's usually somebody who doesn't understand the danger. Typically native folks know a little bit better than that, but I will tell you, there are about 1.2 million alligators, something like that, estimated to be in the state of Florida, and usually about 2 or 3 or 4 people in a busy year get harmed or eaten by an alligator. Like, they're very reclusive. They're not super aggressive towards humans. They're scared of us. They generally stay away from where people are.
Well, there was that video that was making the rounds on Facebook like a week or so ago of that friggin' prehistoric monster alligator on a golf course.
Yeah.
That thing's huge.
15 feet.
And that's here in Florida.
Yeah, he just walks across. And they're like, oh, he's the course mascot. Like, they can be around. We coexist with them. But if you go stomping around where they live or where they're likely to, especially at night, because they come out at night, they love to hunt and eat and kill at night. That's what they do. And so, you know, there's no blame to be had. It's a tragic, terrible thing, just like everything else. And I don't believe that, you know, the last thing you want to be doing is casting blame. A 2-year-old is dead. And I have a daughter just about that age, and I'm horrified to think that, like, even if it was negligence on the part of the parents, like, they're going to believe me without anybody else's coming down on them. They're going to hate. They're going to never, ever live that down for the rest of their lives. So, like, and that with the multiple shootings and the alligator thing, and it's just been a really tough week in Orlando.
It's funny you say that, too, because it's one of the things that when you hear about something happening and a child dies, and they say there's some negligence maybe on the parents, and people start screaming that we need to have these people prosecuted. And I think sometimes, is there any punishing that we can do to them that's going to be greater than the punishment that they are already doing to
typically
themselves?
Typically, people who say that don't have kids.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I understand that you feel you need to punish them, but at the same time, what are we possibly going to do that's going to be any worse than what they're already going to?
Nothing.
You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, you've got 2 little girls. I've got a 16-month-old, and she is busy, and she'd get away from you in a second. You know,
sure.
like she, I have turned around to put something in the trash, and she's on the other side of the house, and she'll pull herself up, and she'll be sitting in the rocking chair in her nursery, just smiling at you when you walk in the door. It's like, how did you get in here? How did you get up on that thing? I didn't even know you could climb on chairs yet. You know, like, it's just not for anybody to say. The internet is this public forum where everybody gets to say their stupid, big-mouthed, ill-informed opinions. And guess what? Like, just keep it to yourself. That's how I feel about it. Keep your stupid opinion to yourself.
When Sam was 18 months, I went into the kitchen to make myself a sandwich, and she went outside, got in the car, and went down to the store for smokes.
Oh my God!
You just don't know what they're capable of.
I didn't know she could drive stick.
Yeah, or that she smoked. But you just don't know what they're going to do.
You can always tell when your kids are smoking.
Is that what it is?
Especially when they're little, because lighters are really tough for them.
That's true.
You find fingers. Find a lot of little matchsticks laying around. Anyway, so I've had a very heavy heart, and I'm ready to get back to work. So you and I are going to continue to do what we do. And so thank you, everybody, for hanging with us and for being here. And if you feel differently about things than I do or than Boo Air does, that's okay. We don't hate you. We're entitled to our stupid opinions, just like everybody else is. But we're going to do what we do best, which is talk about photography, enjoy listening to the sound of our own voices, and try to make it as funny as possible, bring a little light and laughter into the world. So Boo Ray, you've got some topics that we can pitch today. We want to talk about the IPC.
Yeah, I think I was going to say, let's just segue right into something that's not at all funny.
Yeah.
And let's talk about the IPC, the International Photographic Competition. Early bird registration is 6/22. The June 22nd is the close of early bird. And then after that, if you still want to get in, you can, but it costs a little bit more money.
It's like an extra $100 or something.
An extra $100?
I think so.
It's extra money. I mean, if you can get it in before 6/22, great. I will be getting mine in. I will start looking at what I'm going to submit on 6/21, probably.
Yeah.
About 11 p.m.
Yeah.
Is when I'll start doing that. So,
and for those of you who actually like to say words, it's June 22nd is the early bird deadline.
Right. So,
if you say 6/22, people are like, oh my God, that's in like 15 minutes.
So June 22nd. So to get ready for getting your images in.
Small background if you're a new listener. The IPC is the International Photographic Competition that PPA, the Professional Photographers of America, puts on every year, where photographers from all over the world compete with qualified judges to be able to test their images against the 12 elements, which are listed on PPA's website. It's just set down to certain criteria. It's a great way to learn, to grow, and if you're competitive, it's a really good way to have some skin in the game, and you get a lot of great unbiased feedback on your work. And again, I will say that being a part of the International Photographic Competition isn't all there is in photography. In fact, over the years, there have been certain areas of photography that sort of aren't even a good fit for this type of competition. However, you don't have to be good at this to be a good photographer, but doing this, learning to do this well, will certainly improve your game.
Yes.
And also, as you get merits and degrees and awards for competing on different levels, you also you get a lot of stuff to market with to your clients, which is one of my favorite parts of it, is to really have that. My clients walk into my studio and I have little ribbons and trophies and stuff from the last 8 years of competing and slowly learning to be successful at it, because when you start, you will take it on the teeth most of the time. There are very few people that just go in, my first year, I just knocked it out of the park, and my image is all merited and then went into the loan collection.
Very few people.
No, not many.
Almost no people go 4 for 4 their first year. You would have to be almost an extraordinary photographer to
go 4 for 4. I would say a demigod.
Almost, to go 4 for 4 your first year. To put in 4 images in the IPC and have all 4 of them merit the first year, practically impossible.
It is, I would say...
Unless you are just... an amazing photographer.
It is a Herculean feat of
Herculean
skill.
In fact.
Yes.
Like when he was older and could already lift the bull.
Right.
Not when he was like the young guy. Not like young, Hercules in the hallway. Did you see Hercules by his locker? No. We're talking about older Hercules. Kick-ass Hercules.
Right.
That's the sort of feat it would be to go 4 for 4 your first year.
Right. Yeah. And, didn't you go 4 for 4 your first year?
I don't like to talk about it, but I did.
Okay.
I did go 4 for 4 my first year.
So
and
basically,
never again since then.
So basically you get 4 entries in a category, and there are 2 main categories, the Photographic Open and Electronic Imaging. Photographic Open focuses on primarily photographic in nature, and then Electronic Imaging focuses on your ability to manipulate images, image restoration, painting in digital paintings, all kinds of stuff. Electronic Imaging is a much broader category. It's sort of like not only how good you are at photography, there are many great photographers who compete in that category, but also how great you are at the digital manipulation of images. Although I think that you could still probably put in hand retouched images from because this category has been around a long time. It's not unique to digital photography, but you can put 4 entries into each category. That'd be a total of 8. And so out of the 4, the images come up before a judge, a panel of judges, usually 6 judges, and then also a jury chair who moderates the judges, and then it will either be a merit or not. And PPA uses the basic, and all this information is on PPA's website if you look under PPA under competitions. But basically, long story short, the magic number for most people is 80. You want to score on a scale which is basically 69 to 100. It's supposed to be 0 to 100, but it's typically 69 to 100 or 65 to 100.
In state competitions and in the regional competitions, everything is given a numerical score.
Right, but because there are too many,
right,
it takes longer to do the number scores. PPA so is basically a thumbs up, thumbs down.
If you know that if you go into a regional or whatever, that you need an 80 or higher when they score you in order to be a merit. So when you go to national, you're still thinking, I need an 80, but there is actual no score.
Right.
It's just yes or no. But those judges, they also do at regional and stuff. So in their heads, they're thinking, is this an 80 or better? You know, and that's what I need to give if I'm going to give this a merit.
And then after, if it scores a merit, that would be a score of 80 or above, or a majority of thumbs up from a panel of judges, it goes to what's called the loan collection judging, which is a collection of basically the best of the best, usually around 500 or so images from the competition, which is anywhere from, you know, 6,000 to 7,000 entries. And they make a book out of it. Marathon Press prints a hardbound book and puts it out every year.
So there's also the showcase collection.
And there is a showcase book also Marathon Press puts it out, which is basically like each judge has given a certain amount of, let's say, chips or whatever. And so if an image does not go loan on a panel, but one judge really likes it and thinks that it's just an excellent image, they can put their chip on that image and say, let's put that one in the book. And that'll go in the showcase book, which is basically...
But there's no merit for that.
There's no additional merit for a showcase image. It's just you get featured in the showcase book. I've had images in both, and it's pretty cool either way. But the long story of the whole thing is that photographic competition has been really instrumental in my career. And so Boo Ray, you also are a regular and successful competitor.
Yes, I am a regular competitor, and will be a regular competitor for some time, because that's how long it will take me some time to finally get my master's.
You know, we'll talk. You know, I'd love to talk about image selection and
I do want to talk about. I want to talk about image selection. I want to talk about big red flags that people make again and again and again when they're first starting out. What I want to do with you, Gary Hughes, somebody who's been through judging class.
I am a judge in training. Yes.
A judge in training, working on being a judge. I want to talk about, for the person who is entering for the first time, because I have thoughts on this and you have thoughts too. Entering the first time, I want to talk about the biggest mistakes you see people make all the time.
Absolutely.
Because these are also big mistakes that if you correct them, they will help you in competition. But they're also big mistakes that if you correct them, they help you, period.
Absolutely.
Overall.
There are certain things that you'll learn that they'll say in competition that's not just a competition rule or guideline. It's like something that will make your photography better in general.
Right.
Like, if for example, I've had images where I've had hands posed in the image in a way that was not as flattering. And there's just a universal rules of flow and design telling the image, the viewer of your image, where to look. And so if you have a hand posed in a way that is not ideal for that image, then one of the judges might say, you know what, I'd really love to see the hand turned a little more to the side and diminish it so that you can get to the face easier, stuff like that. And that doesn't something that you want to just think about in competition. When you pose your image in the first place, you should go, wow, that makes a lot of sense. You
know? Right.
And even if you pick up an issue of Vanity Fair.
I pay much more attention to hands now than I ever did before I started
competing. And then you'll see how hands are used in images and you'll see a lot of these rules that and guidelines and criteria by which judges in the International Photographic Competition and even WPPI's competition use to critique images, you will look at high-quality professional commercial portraiture, and you'll see those same rules being used all the time.
All the time.
Like using the golden triangle and the rule of thirds, the rule of fifths, the rule of eighths, you know, hand posing, direction of lighting. There's so much of this stuff that is just pervasive throughout photography. And I recently was in Washington, D.C., and whenever I'm in a city that has a great portrait gallery, I always go. I always go to art galleries, and I always love the portraits. I'm a huge nerd of colonial-era portrait painters, you know, like
me too,
John Singer Sargent and such and so on. And so I was at the National Portrait Gallery recently, and I'm walking around looking at stuff all the way from the late 1600s all the way up to the Civil War era. They had a whole exhibit on Civil War era portraits, photography. And I'm looking at like, that would merit right now. You could put that into PPA's International Photographic Competition today in the portrait category, and that would merit, you know, because the rules weren't invented by PPA or WPPI or any other organization. These things are things that's the pioneers of image making way back to the Renaissance portrait painters created to make some guidelines to say this is what this is what you should be trying to achieve. And so, you know, I think that one thing is that people will enter once, not do well, and never come back. That's right. The thing that I would encourage you to not do is because the first time I entered, I was not as lucky as you. I got my teeth kicked in.
Lucky?
Yeah. I was not as
lucky.
Yeah, I was not as successful as you. I stand corrected. I was not as successful as you. I got one merit, three nothings. I got, and that was it.
And to tell you how frustrating it can be, the images that I went 4 for 4 my first year, I feel that there are so many images since then that I have entered that are stronger that have not merited.
Right.
So it's you can't get too bent out of shape when you don't merit. You know, I'm a person, I'm very cool and relaxed about whether or not I merit all the time, and I never seem to have a problem if I merit, if I don't merit, it doesn't matter to me. I'm waiting for Gary to interrupt me and go, "You are lying, sir."
No. I agree. I mean, the thing is, it is at the end of the day, even though there are guidelines, the judges are very well trained, and every single PPA judge, or also called jurors, by the way, if we throw that terminology, every PPA juror has to go through an incredibly long process, which we've detailed on the show before, to become, I'm in the middle of that process right now.
Right.
And not only that, but you have to compete or else you can't be a judge.
Here's the thing.
You have to compete successfully.
Here's the thing I think that's hard for a lot of people going into competition to wrap their head around. It was hard for me. Is that it's about what the judges want to see. It's about the guidelines. It's about the rules. But it's also about once you start competing more and more and talking to people who compete a lot, you will begin to hear things over and over. This is the sort of thing that judges don't like. We were looking at one of my pictures, joking about it just yesterday, and you said you need to fix that harsh shadow because the judges don't like to see where the light's coming from.
Right.
Right. And the thing you have to understand if you're going to compete is you have to make a decision about what your goal is. If your goal is, I want to merit, that's my goal, then you've got to strip away all ego and a lot of times much of your individual and personal desire of what you like. You've got to say, this is what it takes to merit, and that's what I'm going to produce to merit,
right,
and then I'm going to merit. If you're going to be a person who wants to stand your ground, for example, on the picture we were talking about, I like those shadows, I want those shadows there, I put them there on purpose,
right,
and as a result, I know that it's a toss-up as to whether or not this image is going to merit. Now, I could fix it and have a better shot at the merit, but for me personally, I would rather try and drag the judges down to what I like than to try and meet them.
Right.
Because I think it's a subjective artistic choice.
Right.
And if they don't see it's an artistic choice, I'm okay with the fact that it's not going to merit, and then maybe I'll get them next year. But I personally want to merit with the image that I personally think is strong. But just be prepared for some heartache.
You know,
to be upset.
Here's the thing. Sometimes you like something, and I'm not saying in this particular case with you, but I've had this where I really like something, and then I realize later that I was wrong.
Oh, sure, and that happens too.
You know, and so you're going to change. You have to be open to change as a photographer. Critique is something that, especially I find my generation and younger people, get very, it's hard to take criticism, especially about your work. We're very emotionally attached as creators. We're very emotionally attached to our work. And so it's hard to take, but you have to go into competition saying like, I'm going to come, was not with the intent, because this very rarely happens. There are some people that just, this is what I do, and they put it in, and it blows the judges away, and they do really well. The majority of us have some work to do, and we have some changing to do before we learn who we're going to be as an artist. And so if you're going into the competition going, I'm going to put my stuff in and wait till they get a load of me, you know, and it's, guess what? You're going to get beat to crap, and and all the criticism is constructive. Like, the judges don't say that sucks. The judges, they train you to positively critique an image. They say, well, in this case, I think that the color of this half of the image seems like it wasn't managed as well as this, and you got the two competing light sources that don't really work. You know, they don't go, well, this image sucks, 60. You know, they won't speak unless they're building up. You know, unless they're saying something that, here's something that you could improve, a properly trained judge, you know. And so it is hard, though, even to hear constructive criticism, especially when the biggest frustration that people face sometimes is when judges are talking about an image and they're saying, and they say, they make an assumption or they say something, yes, and you're like, but I did that on purpose. When they call something out in the image as being a negative,
Right.
And you say, but I like that, and I did that. But here's you have to be open to the fact that, one, it's subjective, and two, you might be wrong.
You might be wrong.
And
or,
that's okay.
Yeah, you know, but by that same token, you might be wrong, but sometimes maybe they just haven't caught up with you yet, or maybe... they caught up with you 4 years ago when that was popular, and now it's not really popular anymore, and you haven't caught up to the fact that it's not. They've seen it before, and they don't like it.
Well, that's the thing, is it's not about what's popular. That's what people, they put in something that's really trendy and really hip, and it will, and the judges will just go, look, we're trained to look at these elements for right. these, and that they will speak to the image they're looking at. They will speak using the 12 elements of a merit image, and they will... they're not trickery and cutesiness and quirkiness are very rarely something that they've seen. Let me tell you, if they're sitting there judging one of your images, there isn't much they have not seen.
Well, the thing you just have to go into it with the attitude of, I'm trying to get past these judges. You know, whoever I get, I mean, you talk to the people who do this, the people who are master photographers and have 8,000 bars on their string, and they're still competing every year. And for them, they are not at all looking at their images in terms of their own personal ego and what they like anymore.
No.
When they got an image, it's just, I've done this so much, and I've dealt with so many judges, and I've heard so many critiques, so I'm just going to look at this image, and as Tim Kelly said, I'm going to remove everything from it that might count against it.
Right.
And then when I've done that, it has to merit.
Well, I want to tell you, as someone who is going through the training process, that it is not an adversarial relationship. The judges sitting around there, any judges who are just there to show how smart they are they don't stick around long.
Right.
Like the mood is, judges want to get behind an image. They want to like the images. They want the images to do well. They want you to succeed. So it's like when they're speaking, they're not speaking because they want to show, you know, how smart they are and what they know that you don't. It is, believe me, they don't get, I mean, they get paid like a per diem that covers their hotel to fly to Atlanta and to do
yeah,
this.
It's in no
and
way.
They come from all over the country. They're not making any money off of it.
No.
It's not a, you know, it is, they are volunteering to do this and to provide education. So they don't go through the years it takes to become a judge and to sit there and do that. Just
it costs $600 to take the judging class. $600 just to take the class, and there's no guarantee you'll get to be a judge.
No, you got to go through several years most of the time of judging and being critiqued as a judge.
Yeah,
and get, you know, and so,
and out of state.
Yeah.
So now you got to travel to all these other states and judge there.
It costs a lot of money and a lot of time to get there to that point.
A lot of money and a lot.
You really got to want to educate. You really got to be passionate about competition, passionate about educating other photographers, and be willing to serve. These are good people. Some of the coolest, best, most creative, dynamic image makers.
Sure.
Awesome people you'll ever meet. When we were at Gwinnett Technical College, which is in outside of Atlanta, which is where they put on the IPC every year, the judges all hang out like in the lobby of the hotel and just drinking wine and beer, and it's like, you know, a couple of people, they'll bring instruments and like they hang out, and it's just a bunch of really cool creatives hanging out, and they talk about the images sometimes, like, oh man, I saw this image, it was so great, I couldn't believe how cool that was. Like, they, when an image goes alone or does really well or scores 100 in a regional competition or something, they applaud.
Yeah, like, it's infectious.
They are so excited about the art of image making. So I just want to point out that in my very educated opinion on this particular matter, it is not an adversarial process.
No.
It's not like you're trying to slide a puck past the goalie. It's like you just, so you have to dial in. My advice for competition is this: what you shoot on a day-to-day basis sometimes isn't competition kind of images. You know, like I shoot a lot of corporate headshots, and the majority of what I do on a daily basis is a flat lit corporate headshot on white, and that's just not gonna really do well in competitions. They'll go, yeah, this is great, but it doesn't have much impact because it's just a, you know, what it just is what it is. You have to find out how to take what you do on a daily basis and marry that with what does well in competition and find a way like to get halfway between those two things, because you don't necessarily, I don't agree with just setting up a whole bunch of, although I don't think this is a bad thing, but I don't set up a whole bunch of personal shoots and come up with wacky ideas and get a whole makeup and styling team in to do a personal project and then compete with that. Everything I compete with the exception over the years of a couple of travel images and the odd personal project, I actually posted one on our Facebook page today that I merited 2 years ago. But 90% of everything that I've ever put in competition has been my client work from day to day.
Right.
And that's how I choose to do it. I don't think there's anything wrong fine with not doing that, but that it just feels more authentic for me personally to do that. And I have found a way to take what I do, which is actors' headshots and corporate headshots, and I found a way to working within those parameters to find good competition images. And so my best piece of advice is don't be angry or upset to get to not do well. Like, find your local or state affiliate group who is affiliated with the Professional Photographers of America and get involved in their competitions, because that's, I put, even on our local Orlando group where we have like, you know, 50 members and it's a much smaller group, much smaller competition, we have 3 competitions a year, and I test out all my images at a local level to get feedback before I decide what I'm going to put in the IPC. Mm-hmm. And so get involved in your local PPA affiliate and practice at those lower level competitions. Don't do it once and quit. That's not learning anything. That's you just, you know, that's your hubris. You know, that's your bruised ego. And I would also say that it is important to go into it with the right attitude. You have to go, you have to say, this is an educational thing for me that I can also get better at and leverage as an opportunity for marketing, for networking, for growth with my peers. And then eventually you could teach other people how to be good at it too. So there's so much cool stuff involved with it. And it has been, it was hard. First couple of years didn't go great, but you know, it's worth doing. I would say that for sure.
I would say the best piece of advice I could give you if you're first starting out is to take your image, blur your eyes, look at it, find the brightest spot on your image, and if it isn't a person's face, you need to fix that.
Unless it's a landscape. I would say, if it was a person's face, it'd be weird.
But I would say that is probably the single biggest thing that will get you in trouble, is the brightest spot on your image should generally be the thing that you want people to look at.
Right.
And to me now, that's of course to us, of course. But I remember the first time somebody told me that, and they said, you know, flip your image upside down so that it doesn't even look normal to you. Just flip it upside down and then glance at it.
Where does your eye go?
If it isn't to the face of your subject, you've got a problem and you need to fix that.
Right.
You need to bring that down. You need to burn that down, because I see it happen all the time with judging. It's one of the things that they will immediately call you out for is if the bright spot of your image,
that
the thing that pulls the eye,
one of the most
is
common,
not the
that's
subject.
One of the most common mistakes is not burning and dodging your image to where you have to tell the viewer / judge or whoever where to look. Right. And your eye is going to go to the area of highest contrast, which in most cases is the brightest part of the image.
Right.
And so like say, for example, if you had a snowy field, everything's pretty much white or close to white, snow covered trees, snow covered ground, snow covered fence, and there's a woman in a long red dress in the middle of that field, your eye's going to go right to that woman.
Sure.
Because that's the area of highest contrast. And so it is more often than not, it is the brightest thing in the image, because most images are medium and low key. But when you get to high key image, the brightest thing is always the background or everything else but the subject. So keep that in mind, that you have to tell people where to look with your image. And the other biggest mistake I see people make is lack of presentation. I think that they'll just upload an image, and the whole system is based around sort of matting and printing of images. And they still accept physical prints as well as digital entries. But I see people, they just upload a file and there's no matting. There's no presentation. There's nothing. And there's no title. You know, they'll put it as untitled, or they just title it the name of the person in the image. And a really strong image will stand on its own. But I've never seen anything score better because it didn't have a presentation. I've never seen anything score better because it had, you know, it was untitled. Things will typically, judges expect a title, and the title is the only thing about your work that you get to say to the judges. It's the only apologetics. It's the only defense you have of what you did. It's the only way, because you look at your image, you know the person, you know the story behind it, you know how hard it was to make, you know everything about that image. But if you just put up a picture of a bride with a tear in her eye or rolling down her cheek, and you just call it the crying bride, that's pretty obvious. But if you title it something like Missing Dad, it becomes so much more impactful. Like, you put story mm-hmm. behind it. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage you to have a thoughtful, poignant, most of the time short title, and give your image some kind of presentation. And there are resources under competitions on PPA.com that show you how digitally to mat and prepare your images for competition. And there's tons of those resources are all available on their website.
All right, let's talk about what's coming up.
So much.
I have got, let's see, June, July, August. August 23rd, I will be in Jacksonville.
Oh.
I will be in Jacksonville at jppg.org.
You want to hang out with the Jacksvillians?
Yeah, the Jacksvillians. I'm going to go up there and do a little program on 5-minute photography. This is my new program on 5-minute photography, how to take a good portrait in 5 minutes or less, no matter where you are, in any circumstance, any time of day, any location, indoor or out. That's basically the idea behind it, because that's basically what we do as wedding photographers.
Right.
We are under pressure and we have to work fast.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I have developed, I believe, a foolproof system for being able to take a good portrait in any location at any time.
Foolproof is a dangerous term.
Yes, it is. But I'm going to go out on a limb. Because I can do it, and you can do it. If I put you anywhere and said, here's your camera, here's one light and a stand, use it or not, I don't care, but anywhere, couldn't you figure out a way to best use your surroundings and best to pull an image out of that surrounding?
Right. I guess that the idea would be I wouldn't necessarily be able to make the most amazing image in the world, but I could certainly get a competent, well-lit, well-posed portrait.
Yes, yeah. That's my point. And for a lot of people, that is the most harrowing part of being a photographer. A lot of people, that's the flop sweat. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get the you get the family. We want you to take family portraits of us in the park at this park or whatever, and you've got to go there. You've never been there, and suddenly your light changes, and now, oh my God, they've got to be able to think on their feet and solve the problem. This is something wedding photographers do all the time, and more portrait photographers are having to do it because we're expected to shoot on location.
Right.
So I thought that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk about
5-minute photography.
5-minute photography, and that's coming up. And then I'm going to be at the Hampton Inn in Natick, Massachusetts, the month after that on the 19th.
Massachusetts.
In Massachusetts. You can go to ppam.com and find out my details on that. And I'll be doing a full 1-day workshop on wedding photography and 5-minute photography as well.
That's awesome.
That's 1 day long. Coming up, Focus, September 10th and 12th.
Oh, my goodness, yeah.
This is the state convention for Florida, September 10th through the 12th. Go to
Focus 2016,
Are You
In Focus?
Areyouinfocus.com. And the mighty Photobomb podcast will be...
We will be doing Photobomb
and
Live.
And by the way, I have to tell you that, you know, they just had the Florida Professional Workshops was just this
Florida
week.
Photography Workshops, yeah, in Daytona.
In Daytona, it was a week of instruction, or 4 or 5 days of instruction. Mm-hmm. And I have been told that when they had everyone there for the opening starting thing to talk about the whole everything that was coming up, that when they talked about Focus, the very first thing they said was, and we have secured the Photobomb podcast to be at Focus this year.
Boo.
And there was cheering.
What?
Yes. Yeah, so apparently the room went wild.
Did it?
Yes. They're very happy to have us coming.
And by the room went wild, somebody went, what?
Yes, exactly. But apparently I was told that it was like comical how excited people seemed to be.
Wow. Okay. It'll be cool, man. Yeah. I'm so looking forward to it. That's like coming home for us. That's where we came up with the idea for the show. Was at Focus like 2014 or 2013.
At the bar. So we're going to be doing that live as well. What have you got coming up?
Very soon I will be speaking at the Texas PPA Summerfest? Yeah, Summerfest. And it's going to be June 26th through the 29th at this awesome resort called the La Torreta Resort and Spa. And it's basically the Texas Professional Photographers, the Texas PPA, puts on this convention event every summer. And I'm going to be speaking, doing a program on headshot photography. I will also be judging in their competition. And it's going to be a pretty awesome time. Looking forward to that. Then I'm going on vacation immediately after that. I'm going to go see family in New York and New Jersey. And then I also have coming up in July at the Professional Photographers of Louisiana. I'll be speaking and judging at their convention, which is pretty exciting. That's going to be, because that's in New Orleans. That's going to be really cool. So I love New Orleans. I'm taking the family with me. One of the great, wonderful members at the Louisiana PPA hit me up. I posted something in the Headshots with Lori Patrick Facebook group that I'm a member of. And one of the really cool members of the PPA Louisiana hit me up and was like, hey, man, you want to go out on an airboat ride?
Hey.
Yeah. So he's going to take, prospectively, this is the idea, after the convention, we're going to stay a day extra, and we're going to go on an airboat ride.
It's very quiet and serene on the airboat. Airboat. It's like sailing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's not at all. Cool. You have a giant fan right next to your head.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
the loudest thing you've ever
Oh yeah, yeah. They are not quiet. But yeah. So and then big news.
Yeah, I didn't know. I was going to say, are we talking? Are we ready to announce this?
Contract. All right,
let's announce that, baby.
The contract is signed. I am going back on Creative Live.
Yeah.
I will be in the first week of August. I think it's the 4th and 5th of August. I am. But all that is going to be coming up and posted on. I'll put it on social media and it'll be on the Creative Live's website. But I'm doing a new program that is based. It's all about professional portraits. Like the idea is that the last 2-day program I did was all about headshot photography, professional headshots, and the business of professional headshots. However, at least half the time I'm doing professional headshots, I get asked to do group pictures or editorial photos. Like I just photographed the chief of surgery for a hospital in Orlando, and I had to go to shoot his portrait for Orlando Style magazine in this tiny little office. And it's like, what do you do in that situation?
Right.
How do you pose groups? How do you shoot full length? How do you take a picture of the guy next to his company truck? And like all the stuff that you get asked to do that is adjacent to headshots. Because I'll shoot an office with 20 lawyers in it. And then, oh, can you do a group shot? Or, oh, can you take a picture of the CEO or whoever at their desk and all this stuff? So it's going to be all about professional portraiture, editorial portraiture on location and in the studio. All the stuff that is a great companion to headshots. And so it's going to be 2 days on that on Creative Live, August 4th and 5th, I think, are the dates. So going out to Seattle again, that'll be really cool. Great to go to Seattle in August because Florida sucks in August.
Yeah.
A lot. So.
Yeah, what's it like? What's the temperature like in Seattle in August in summertime?
It's like, you know, 68 degrees.
In the summer?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Doesn't get up in the 70s?
I'm sure it does sometimes, but last time we were there, last August, it was like 72-68 degrees,
man.
In the sun. Like, it was cool in the mornings. It was beautiful. It's just the best.
Of course, you don't want to be there in January. That's the problem.
Yeah, well,
it's great in the summer.
It's actually fairly temperate. I don't think it's that bad. I don't.
Really?
Yeah, it's. I mean, you get a lot of rain, but what people in Seattle call rain is like a really heavy, foggy little with a little sprinkle of mist. Like their idea of rain. Where in Florida, we get rain and it's like
tropical storm
every day at 3:30 in the afternoon. The sky turns black and it rains like it's the apocalypse, and then 30 minutes later it's done,
right?
And then it's blue skies and humidity again. Whereas in Seattle there's often a very constant and pervasive just kind of light mist,
right?
And that's happening like for weeks, you know. And so it's you know, it's just not this. It's like I didn't even notice it was raining. I saw a couple people pop up umbrellas. I was like,
Wait, what's that?
Oh, I see. Yeah, all right. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. What are you guys doing?
I didn't know that.
Is it raining?
I thought that they had regular rain all the time, but really it's just the misty stuff.
Well, at least in my experience, I'm sure that they get all kinds of weather, you know, but it's a pretty beautiful, very cool city, and I can't wait to go back. So Creative Live, I'm really excited.
Oh, it's big deal. Big news.
It is. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a lot of fun.
All right.
And then, there was something else. My book is coming out October. Finish editing the book.
Yeah, I haven't quite finished my book, and the deadline was 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, don't worry. I've been working on mine for 18 months.
Okay,
They'll just push it back.
They haven't contacted me and been like, hey, your deadline was 2 weeks ago. Where's your book? But we bought a house. I've been like laying floors and, you know.
So maybe we'll get in the next episode, we'll get an update on the house hunt and how all that's going.
And the book.
So Photographing Headshots is for sale on Amazon now, pre-sale.
All right.
And last thing is, we do have a special deal from White House Custom Color. They are offering their sample sets at a great discount for our listeners. If you go to whcc.com and you look under products and sample sets, what basically it is, it's like if you have, let's say you have a home studio, or you meet your clients in a coffee shop, or you don't have a place to put a whole bunch of wall portraits where you can display them for your clients, or cards and products, whatever it is. The sample sets are basically unbranded product menus that show all the stuff that they offer. So if you are a White House client or use some of their products or are interested, you can get these sample sets of their products that show everything that they have available that you can give to your client as like a product menu without having to buy one of everything that they have.
Right.
So they're a really, really excellent tool for sales, and it's a lot less expensive than buying one of everything to put in your studio. So those are, I believe you get $20 off any $30 or more order. So like you could spend $30 on sample sets and get $20 off that. So that's a pretty great deal. If you go to the sample sets and you order sample sets, when you check out, use the code PHOTOBOMB20
Photobomb 20.
Photobomb 20.
For $20 off.
Photobomb 20, and you will get $20 off $30 or more ordered in San Francisco.
All right. If you'd like to find Gary online, you can find him at HughesTheoretti.com.
Yeah.
You can find me at BooRayPerry.com. You can find our website at PhotobombPodcast.com. You can find us on Facebook at Facebook/PhotobombPodcast. Also, you can find my group, which is on Facebook.com.
It's, Pro Photo Talk.
Pro Photo Talk with Booray. So, yeah, and that's where, you know, I did that because I like to talk about photography, and my family was sick of seeing it on their Facebook feed.
Yeah.
So that's where now if I'm like...
It's a cool group.
If I'm out on a job or something, I'm like, oh, here's what I'm doing today. I take a picture. I just put it there because only photographers care about that crap. Mm-hmm. You know, but also we talk and we have questions and stuff like that. And that's about it, right?
That's about it.
All right. We'll see you next week.
See you later.